CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 122, with Dr. Milind Pandey, harnessing the power of AI to help surgeons and patients. This is going to change everything. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I'm in person with my good friend, Dr. Milind Pandey. And I'm here in Hull in the UK. And you just brought it to my attention that the first time I came to your annual meeting here was 20 years ago.
Amazing, isn't it? Both of us are a lot younger. You are a little bit more than I. And here you are again.
The years go by. If you're a young ophthalmologist, I know all old people say this, but my gosh, the years go by. It doesn't seem like it was 20 years ago. We looked up the date, though, but in fact, it was 2005.
Correct. It was 2005. And it was the year you came and talk to us about aspheric lenses. Those were the days.
Yeah, at the time, aspheric optics was like a very new thing.
It was a new thing.
And people just couldn't believe it. So we had to explain all the optics behind it, what made sense. And yeah. Now, obviously, things change a lot. And we've, since that's just a given now, every lens is going to have some sort of aspheric treatment on it.
Indeed. And both of us have changed in the same way. With time, right. Hopefully right. For the better.
Right. You know, so much has obviously changed in our field. And we were talking earlier about the future is going to be even very different because we have now the advent of AI, which we're starting to see already in ophthalmology.
Yeah, it is. It's, I think it's the biggest thing, the biggest technology change that's coming our way over the next 10, 20 years. Yeah. We still don't know how it's going to pan out, but we know it's definitely going to be disruptive.
Right.
In almost every aspect of our lives, personal as well as professional.
Right.
And the sooner we get to grips with the actual potential of the technology, how to make use of it correctly, safely, effectively, is going to be the challenge, the key for all of us to work together to deliver the potential benefits of this technology
right.
for our patients.
Right. My thing back to just even, let's say, 5 years ago, where you'd be at a national meeting, they talked about how the AI is reading these retina scans.
Yeah.
And from a fundus photo, it can tell male versus female. I don't know how, because I cannot. It can tell age within like a year or two, which is amazing. I mean, I can tell a pediatric retina, a young person's retina from an older person's retina, but to within a year or two is I don't understand. And it can even tell you a whole host about like systemic disease of the patient.
I don't think even the AI understands. Because
right.
as we know, this is a result of deep learning models.
Right.
Which is unsupervised learning. You just give it the data, it learns itself, but it cannot explain it to you. And that's a big challenge in healthcare
right.
AI.
Right.
That we can't expect doctors to accept an AI telling them, if you give us this image, this is what you need to do, but I can't explain to you
what?
How and why.
Right.
So yeah. That's a big challenge in AI applications in healthcare, is this concept of explainable AI, this concept of interpretable AI.
Mm.
And regulatory authorities look at these things with grave concern.
And an abundance of caution.
An abundance of caution, indeed. So those challenges are going, there are already approaches in place
yeah.
to try and get these AI deep learning models to come up with explanatory indicators of how they're looking at what they're coming up with the answers.
Right.
But that process is just starting. But as you know, AI is not just deep learning. AI is not just machine learning. AI has been around for more than 50 years.
Sure.
And the techniques of AI really revolutionized when ChatGPT came on.
Publicly accessible, basically.
Because suddenly we had a computing change with the NVIDIA graphic processor,
right.
parallel processing chips, which allowed for huge amounts of compute power needed for generative AI. And that's really what's caught the fancy of everyone. So invariably, everyone thinks AI is ChatGPT, is generative AI.
Mm.
But the history of AI goes back a long way, and there are many techniques which we could use from those AI techniques, which are generally fall into that category of what's called symbolic AI, which I explained, well, we can derive everything, we know how it works, right, and hence have much more confidence in being able to validate for use in our domains.
Right, I think when we don't know how it works, it's a little off-putting. Like, okay, I understand the AI for like the image thing of the retina, it's very accurate and it can tell me male or female. But how, why? Teach me so that I can do that.
But that's not the point, is it, then?
No,
it's the other side of the coin comes if, for example, we accept, okay, we don't understand what the AI does, we don't understand how it does, and we accept that AI's conclusions and act on it for a patient,
okay,
who is liable?
Right.
The AI, or is it the surgeon that's liable?
Right.
Or the doctor that's liable? So there is a big gap between what we call bench AI to bedside AI.
Yeah, for sure.
There are multiple areas of concern or validation that needs to happen before we can apply bench AI to bedside AI. And that's the reason why we have so few validated, clinically used AI systems currently. It'll change as we get better at doing this, but we're just starting on this journey. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be always the surgeon is the cap of the ship, and it's always your fault.
Absolutely.
And we're going to fall into that.
I totally agree with you. I don't think AI is capable of replacing humans in any field of endeavor at this moment in time.
Yet.
It may,
yeah,
but at the moment, even simple things like customer service, for example, right, which is what everyone sells AI for nowadays with chatbots.
Right.
You still need customer service agents.
Right.
To drive that, but you can make your existing customer service agent more efficient.
Sure.
More responsive, sure, by using AI. So that's a level of use. Now in healthcare, the surgeon carries the can. The surgeon is the ultimate boss, the responsibility, right, for this. So AI can only assist the surgeon. The surgeon will always have and should have the final say, the final choice,
right,
in determining what they do to the patients.
Right. I mean, we got around that one way in when we did our initial AI-based IOL calculations, that we assigned a tether, a dog leash, if you will, that the AI can only change the IOL power by either a half diopter or one diopter most, or maybe one and a half if you're aggressive.
Sure.
So if you think the calculation is 20, you'd be okay if the AI said it's 20.5 or
correct,
19.5.
Correct.
But if you think it's 20 and the robot says, or the AI says it's 30 diopters, you're like, wait a minute. So to prevent these crazy out of bounds answers, we just assigned a tether or a leash.
So the question there is, how do you know it's the AI that's wrong and not the surgeon?
You got to do the surgery, and then we're going to find
then
out.
You got to find out, yes.
But you know, you've noticed this too in your career. As you go, as the decades go by, you built up a bit of an intuition. You know, I had a case, especially lens calcs, because I had a patient recently, and they print out the IOL calcs, and it comes up both eyes, and both look reasonable. But there's an anisometropy in the IOL powers of 1.5 diopters. And I think that's okay, but the axial lengths are the same. And then I look at what's the patient's habitual glasses refraction, what glasses have they come in wearing. There's really no anisometropy there. Well, then I had to like pause and think, all right, wait a minute, then let me look at the K's. What's different here? Oh, and on one, they had a K measurement that fooled the machine. I think it was a good K measurement, obviously it was not.
Correct.
So it was the onus on me to catch that. And now, later in my career, it sticks out immediately.
Yeah.
But if I was 5 years into practice, that wouldn't be so obvious.
Indeed. And we used to be taught to do prior refractive reconciliation of the biometry outputs.
Right, right.
The moment you do that, it'll pick these things up.
Sure.
If you have pre-cataract refractions available to you.
Yeah.
Your current biometry should be consistent with that.
Of course.
Yeah. And this is one of the things we have implemented as validation in this new custom lens AI lens surgery platform we are building.
Tell me about this project you're building. Custom lens AI. Tell me about
it. Custom lens AI. So the problem we are trying to solve is the poor penetration of surgery, which gets patients good unaided vision.
Right.
After surgery.
Hitting the target.
Hitting the target is one thing, yeah. But hitting the target for the sphere, for the cell, for the presbyopia, the lot.
Right.
You and I have been doing this for more than 20 years.
Sure.
The technology has evolved, and yet only 15% of the world's cataract surgery, lens surgeries are done using these techniques.
Right.
And the trend line is more or less flat. Mm. And this is despite the technology being so much better than what it was 20 years ago.
Right, for sure.
We've done that. The cost is better, improved. And the industry and institutions and organizations have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on surgeon education.
Right.
And yet, we are at this level. So our thoughts were, and this is something I believed in, is that there is actually a surgeon barrier. What I mean by that is surgeons are uncomfortable when they have to sit around and do mathematics and physics and calculate.
Right.
What the astigmatism is, what the meridian is, right. what this is, what type of lens to choose. And the second aspect of the challenge comes in setting patient expectations in a confident and accurate and realistic manner.
Sure.
So those were the two components we identified as what we call the surgeon barrier. So we designed an expert system with predictive AI combined, which automates the full surgical plan. So a technician will enter the history, the clinicals, the examination, the diagnostics, whichever you want, lifestyles, everything. And we've generated the custom lens algorithm, which generates the full, what I call the surgical prescription, which is every bit of information you need to go and do surgery. So it's like a work order for the surgeon to go and execute in surgery. It'll be the incision, whether it's a corneal incision, the meridian of the incision, what type of lens, the actual model, the spherical power, the post-op, the toric power, where do you put the lens, if it's a toric lens, at what meridian, what anesthesia, and what kind of unique features that particular eye has.
So the works.
The works. And hence, it's called the surgical prescription.
Right.
And the second algorithm we've developed is what we call the panfocal algorithm, which is based on a unique way I developed about 10 years ago to measure functional vision in my patients.
Okay.
And I used to use that to drive the full surgical process. And what this involves is we measure the functional vision in three dimensions.
Okay.
The first dimension is visual acuity.
Standard, still acuity, okay.
But it's visual acuity in distance, intermediate, near photopic, and near mesopic.
Oh, okay, so a lot more data.
A lot more data. The second dimension is objective task assessment. So my patients would sit in the clinic and look at a standardized page on a desktop, on a laptop, or an iPad for intermediate vision tasks. And we gave them four different nature of reading tasks to do.
All right.
Which was a newspaper, Harry Potter, a shiny Vogue magazine, as such. And it was, what is the fourth thing I forget? Newspaper, Harry Potter, that. There's a fourth element to this.
Maybe a computer screen or an iPhone or something. But
yes.
But so different types.
Different types, because they all have different contrasts.
Right.
And we capture this data, monocular, binocular, photopic, mesopic. For the visual acuities, we capture unaided, distance corrected, fully corrected.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And the third dimension we capture is the patient's own perception of their vision without glasses.
All right.
For distance in good light, distance in poor light, intermediate, okay. Near good light, near poor light.
A ton of data.
Ton of data.
That's why you need the AI to analyze all the data.
And with these three dimensions, what we found was I could describe to a patient, and the patient will understand very clearly where they are with their vision in terms of the ultimate aim of getting our patients to good vision without glasses from infinity to 40 centimeters in a continuous manner with the highest binocular contrast and the least amount of dysphotopsia. So we have this data set going back from our patients with different lenses, with different techniques or combinations and everything, in order to be able to predict that if you use a particular surgical plan, your patient will see this at the 95% probability.
Wow, that's spectacular.
Because we set that threshold to be clinically relevant.
95 is very impressive. Because, you know, you may not realize, a lot of ophthalmologists, I'd say most ophthalmologists in the community, are not even tracking the outcomes of cataracts. They just kind of guess, they're most of my patients are on plain. No, truth be told, I think nationwide in the U.S., for surgeons using advanced biometry, it's about 70% of patients are plus or minus a half diopter of target.
Yeah.
And that's just fear. Forget still or anything else.
And hence this thing of, in the UK, the Royal College of Ophthalmology runs an annual prospective national ophthalmology cataract audit. Okay? Mm-hmm. More than 150,000, or huge number of cases it's done. That definition of postoperative visual acuity is any of the following: unaided vision, best corrected vision, or pinhole vision.
Well, they're so different. How do you compare those?
Whatever is available on the record is what it turns out to be. And the best of those. And in spite of this loose definition, one third of eyes in this year's audit did not have any postoperative visual acuity recorded. Any. And this is an improvement from 50% 2 years ago.
Wow.
So when you do the literature search for real-world data on unaided vision, it's amazing how little there is.
Right.
We have unaided vision data coming out from the lens studies, regulatory studies, but in these audits?
Not really.
Not really.
Wow.
And this is even for distance.
Sure.
Forget about the rest of it. So when we talk of spherical equivalence, that's plus minus 0.5%, that doesn't correlate with unaided vision. You need plus minus 0.5 for sphere and cylinder.
Right, yeah, for sure.
And we know that even in the best hands, only 80% get to plus minus 0.5 on the sill front.
Yeah, for sure.
So when you combine the two, this is, I believe, this is the biggest unmet need in lens surgery.
We got to get the word out then.
Indeed. 30 million procedures done a year, of which more than 22 million people are, what I call it, condemned to spectacles.
Yeah.
Think of the person in the low-income countries who cannot afford surgery, is given surgery as a voluntary free thing. The WHO standard for good surgery is 6/18/20/60 with glasses.
2060, wow, okay.
With glasses.
So the corrected, wow.
So the person cannot afford surgery. You do this, you give them a pair of glasses. Guess what happens in 6 months
when
the
glasses
crash? And they're back to square one, they can't afford it. So even if, and these people use monofocal lenses there.
Right.
So even if we get that group of people to the driving standard of vision without glasses, which is eminently feasible, imagine the change in their life and the quality of life that we can achieve.
Right, of course. Yeah, it was huge.
And yeah. You just have got to do it smarter. That's all.
Right.
So the challenge for us really is when we do these type of surgeries, the process we have is difficult to scale up efficiently.
And that's why it has such a low penetration.
Exactly. And hence this platform where you don't need to think anything. You just put the data in and this will tell you everything.
Here's
you need
the prescription.
To
do this to the eye.
Do this to the eye. And you'll have full control,
yeah, of course.
Whatever you want to do to change that. And along with that, you'll be able to sit down and talk to the patient and say, if we do this, you'll be able to see this, this, this. You'll be able to do these tasks. Mm-hmm. And this is what previous patient had seen before.
And they understand this ahead of time before undergoing the procedure.
And we've designed a specific patient-friendly screen for patient education, which we call the Vision Coach AI, which is custom designed to make it so easy for patients to understand and relate to what's happening with them.
So if I understand this, so the patient has their measurements that you've done. So you have all this biometry, axial length and Ks and AC depth and topography and tomography, everything. The patient then also gives their input in terms of a questionnaire and how do I use my eyes, my needs for my vision, what am I willing to tolerate? And then the custom AI, custom lens AI, will put all this together, set a patient expectation, and give you a prescription that say, if you do this, patient's going to be happy.
Exactly.
Oh, because it's so much easier.
It will be, yes. And along with the inputs you outlined, we also capture the full clinical history and examination.
Right.
So it is a lens surgery platform. You don't need to use any other electronic health record for your lens surgery.
All done there.
If you wish to do this. Because the aim is we want people to, and this doesn't finish at surgery. We then have a surgical record which bring in, and then a post-operative records which we've designed in such a way to drive the second eye choice of IOLs. So you can imagine as time goes by, the volume and quality of data that's going to come into the system,
better and better,
which we will continually use to evolve further AIs. That's the dream. That's the plan.
Right. It'll get better and better. You go through the first thousands or 100,000 patients. It's okay. Here were the accuracy of the refractive side. Here's the patient's input in terms of how their visual is afterwards. And you keep honing it better and better and better. So you hone not only the accuracy for the prescription that the surgeon will do, but you hone the accuracy of the expectation you set for the patient.
Exactly. And we've got a full outcomes analysis system built into this. Plus, we would be able to generate, after the event, what may have happened if an alternative strategy was used for that patient.
Well, so that's very interesting.
So all those simulations and everything will then start coming through.
Right, right.
The challenge here is in terms of validating the AI procedures.
Okay.
Because we don't intend at this moment in time to do live inline AI.
Okay.
We want to do the AI off the system, generate the algorithms,
sure,
test it through the system, and only plug it into the system if it makes a clinically relevant difference to the outcomes.
Makes sense.
Yes. So this is the first core strategy of generating this platform into which we can plug as and when we want, whatever new insights and generate we can do. The other application of this is going to be things, let's say you are an organization which has 50, 60 clinics all around the place. And you want to implement clinical governance standards right across the organization.
All right.
So you could plug those into the system at an organizational level, and everyone in your organization has to follow that.
They'll all be on the same page, for sure.
So you can imagine the benefits of being able to implement, okay, in my organization, I only want multifocal users, multifocals to be used for this criteria. Mm-hmm. I want this for this criteria.
Yeah, for sure.
And you can't have a relatively non-expert surgeon and an experienced surgeon maybe wanting to do something different, but they'll be guided through this. So I think of this as an expert system,
right,
where we transfer expertise at the drop of a hat because we've encoded it so that it's available for anyone and everyone to use with predictive AI and with a pipeline we have, which is set up to explore every aspect of AI that we can think of to apply to this.
Wow, that's wild. So this big change is coming.
That's what we're hoping for, yes. And that's the exciting thing. And that's the reason why 2 years ago I decided to dedicate almost all my professional time onto this project.
Well, it sounds like there's even more than a full-time job.
It is. It's exciting because we've got an IT team. You know how it is when you have to go around organizing a new venture and getting it through. But it's very exciting. And wherever I have talked about it and presented it, it's been very well received.
Yeah, for sure.
So we are now started. We've done the first platform. We have started the algorithm validation and beta testing, because the first step we want to do is we want to validate that our customer lens algorithm, which generates the surgical plans,
right,
thinks the same way as some of the best experts on the planet.
Sure. So it's kind of democratizing that extreme surgical expertise to all surgeons.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
I think that's the only thing, that's the only way we're going to push that needle from 15 to what I hope we can do to 50% within 5 years of us going commercial.
Right.
And it's a win-win for everyone in the ecosystem.
For sure. Well, especially the patients.
Patients is the critical thing, but
Surgeons happier,
lens companies are happier, they're selling more premium lenses, the outcomes are better for patients, big organizations can effectively implement all these changes, and we'll be ready for anything that comes through the AI pipeline.
Well, then we'll be ready to get that surgical prescription and give it to the new robots that are coming to do the surgery.
That could well happen.
I think it's not too far in the future.
It is not too far. And that whole chain starting from imaging diagnostics, where the AI will diagnose, our intelligence and intelligent systems like these will form the surgical plans.
Yeah.
And then either the robots or surgeons will execute those plans in that way.
Right.
I think we're heading that way, but I'm not sure what timelines we're looking at. I suspect it's a lot longer than what we think it will be. But potentially, in 15, 20 years' time, that could well be the way.
I think even before.
Yeah.
If you just look now at the strides that have been made, forget ophthalmology for a minute. Even just now, you do any search engine, Google, whatever you do, the first results now come up in AI generative box there. It gives you your answer before it shows you the search results.
Yes. Google is history. I don't use Google. I use AI. Perplexity.
Yeah.
Just don't use Google anymore.
Perplexity. I don't know this one.
Custom. This is an AI model which is custom designed for search.
I'm going to have to look that up.
So it gives you actual references of all its sources.
Oh, wow.
So it's like all these models, they all have special emphasis and niches that they're carving. Google Gemini 2.5 itself is an amazing model for certain aspects. ChatGPT, everyone knows about Grok, and then Claude. As you know, more than 50% of the world's computer code is now written by AI.
Right, I just was reading today, big layoffs from a lot of the tech companies because they don't need people to write code anymore.
Correct.
Oh, gosh.
So it's like having an assistant, an assistant who does what you tell them to do, but it still needs a person to drive that, to ideate, to conceptualize, to think about what is it they wish to achieve, and more importantly, have the domain expertise to judge the quality of the output that comes out. Because without that, you're dead. you get simplistic nonsense that people send on cut and paste AI outputs, which you can tell straight away. It's not fit for purpose in that sense. But if it's used this way, so I've taught myself a lot about these things in AI.
For sure.
So for example, I play around. One of the things I created is I created a wrap.
Okay.
For custom lens AI. Took me 35 minutes to do. I got the AI to write the lyrics, took it to another AI to set it to music and everything, played around with it. And I play this in my talks. I put it up and the audience first gets stunned, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. And then halfway through they start bobbing. But the rap actually tells them what custom lens AI is about.
That's really neat.
Yeah. So it's a lot of experimentation. But at a foundational level, the basic mathematics, the basic science of generative AI limits its functionality, its potential functionality. So as you know, it's all the tokenization, and then they have to build a probability space for every predictive token that's going to come through. Now, Yann LeCun comes up with this. Yann LeCun is the head of AI at Meta.
Okay.
He comes up with, he explains this in a beautiful way. He says, if we think of the amount of information that's on the internet, which is what all these models have been trained on, trillion parameters or billions of parameters, it's the equivalent of a four-year-old having received the same information in 4 years through the optic nerves.
Oh, okay, wow. Now,
in 4 years, what that human child learns is a totally different scale to what your AI learns.
Right.
So the efficiency of learning is an issue. More importantly, current AIs cannot predict, they do not have a sense of the physical world around us. We can get up, walk, because our brains already have a physical 3D space models to work within. AIs can't.
Mm.
So at least now they can't. Yeah. And people have tried doing experiments where they train the AI with videos to see if they can build a 3D models of that. But the variation is such in a video that it's very difficult, unlike with language, where it's there is a certain code we built into the language. So there are some fundamental AI science leaps that have to occur for AI to go from where we are now to what's that holy grail of human intelligence or advanced general artificial intelligence, AGI, or those kind of things. Forget super duper whatever. So
that's the move. So to clarify, because I'm still learning all this, obviously, the move from, let's say, what we call regular AI now, which is maybe enhanced pattern recognition, to artificial general intelligence, AGI, which is kind of like actual thinking.
Thinking, indeed.
That's a big leap.
So another way of thinking about it is AI explains without understanding.
Okay, which is what we have now. We talked about images and the retina. Right? Yeah, sure.
Correct. And that's the reason why it fails many a times to do basic mathematics.
Yeah.
That's why it fails to generate images where you ask the person to hold the pen in the left hand.
Right.
That's the reason why it fails to generate watch faces showing the time at 6:30, because invariably they'll say 10 and 2.
Right.
Because that's the source of the training data it's been trained on.
Right.
That's the reason why if you ask it to generate a scene of a hospital in Africa, there's a white doctor and black patients.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's the training data set that there is.
Yeah.
And there have been multiple such issues of using AI, which is biased. So facial recognition.
Yeah.
There's a very famous TED Talk where this AI researcher from MIT, an African-American lady, tested various facial recognition systems, which worked on all her white colleagues. But not her. Till she put a white mask on.
Wow, that's so interesting.
the facial recognition systems that were implemented by law authorities in the states and various different states was error-prone. And as a result of that, it gave totally wrong answers in recognizing African-American faces. But because of the police force not being trained properly to use those systems, they did what the computer told them to do.
Oh, boy.
And you get miscarriage. So there is a big issue with the hype.
Yeah.
And having realistic expectations and understanding the limitations of what AI technology can do currently. Until we recognize them, we will never be able to use them consistently in a safe manner for our patients.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ethical considerations coming up with AI that I don't know if we've fully thought through.
I can't see how we can think through it because we don't have the full flavor of what this technology will get us. It's like 25 years ago when the internet was just starting in its current form. No one would have predicted all the social media hype and the Web 2 and the Web 3 and the metaverse and all these things that evolved. They did. We just had the start of this.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's hard to predict where it'll go. We see little examples, like we see the videos that were generated by AI. If you look at them from a few years ago, they looked very crude.
True.
But I saw one recently that was, it could have fooled me.
True.
So in the future, can you just have an AI write a beautiful story, ChatGPT or whatever, and then have the video AI make it into a movie for you? Do you need this? Do I need a movie studio? Do I need an actor?
I think you do. And the reason for that is AI will only be able to get you the average output. It's the difference between having someone who really is at the top of the game and can pick up just by feel, this is slightly different, this is slightly different, if you do it this way, if you do it this way. So that excellence, which requires individual variation based on non-tangible, intangible things, that will always be there. So that level of expertise is always going to be valued, recognized. It's the average things. It's the things that anyone does on a formulaic basis. They will be the easy stuff to replace.
Right.
So entry-level computer code, yes. But you want to start building complex applications and do processing and all that stuff.
Not much.
That ain't happening.
Yeah.
And the person who's going to drive that has to have the expertise to judge what the output is.
Right. I mean, if you go look at us doing surgery then, at the beginning of our careers, we're a little bit more basic and step-by-step for surgery. And then after you've done, let's say, tens of thousands of cases, you pick up such subtleties in the procedure that you just know something's going to happen. You know something's different.
Indeed. Indeed. And it's like you might be working at a completely so-called spinal level, but you're alert to any variations in what you see. And you pick things up much earlier than anyone else would. So that level of expertise will always be there.
But can the AI learn it fast? Meaning, a couple decades ago, as a surgeon, you'd have to experience a lot of complications to understand them. You experience the fake wound burn. You experience.
Sure.
But now, the younger generation of ophthalmologists can learn what I learned in 10 years. They can learn in 1 year because they can just absorb all these high-def videos. And someone like me on CataCoach, I'll teach you all the secrets.
Correct.
What you can learn in a year is spectacular. It would take a decade to learn.
Correct.
But so then can't the AI also just speed up the learning?
Yes, it can. It can, and definitely it does.
Yeah.
Because you can do that now. In many situations, I would kind of brainstorm with the AI in a conversational mode. I'll put it on voice mode and just start talking as you would to your research assistant or any assistant you have. And it will engage with you in a conversation which will take you to different aspects of what you're wanting to explore and set off new thoughts as you go along. So in the ideation, in the conceptualization of any activity, any ideas, it's a great tool. And the same thing will apply for any kind of issues like that. So it's an efficiency tool currently, put it like that. Okay, it's an efficiency tool.
But it keeps evolving. It's getting better.
It keeps evolving, and it will get better. And it is getting better because they are now combining the generative AI with the reasoning models on top, which is the old symbolic style AI, to build these agents who can actually start doing some stuff for you at a relatively independent level.
All right, tell me the truth. How many more years do I have to make Cataract Coach videos? Because now, in the future, you have your AI can watch 10,000 videos, pick up all the subtleties. It'll learn from the way I've done the voiceover already. It could do a voiceover for a video that I give it in my own voice. How many years away is that? 5 years?
I think most of that you can do now.
Now?
You can do, it's capable of doing that now. The challenge is the compute power. To learn from all those videos.
That's hard. It's a lot of computing.
And to try and do that with the current mathematics of building up probability spaces where your AI has to predict this next video frame or the video pixel it comes in, can you imagine the compute power required?
Well, okay, look at this. Just look at regular HD, 1920 by 1080. So the video, each screenshot is 2 megapixels, 2 million pixels.
Correct.
And they're, let's say, 30 frames a second.
Yes.
So that's 60 million pixels a second you have to analyze.
And that's just pixels.
That's just the pixels.
The patterns in the pixels and the interrelationships of those pixels which generate the images is a different scale altogether.
Then that's how amazing are our brains that we can sit here and watch this and take in that mega amount of data so fast.
And filter it and sieve it and make patterns. So my latest insight in neuroprocessing and brain function is this concept of what's called a predictive brain.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of this.
I don't even know. Tell me, what's a predictive brain?
So,
I wish I had one.
Oh, you do have one. I always thought our senses senses the sensory information. We create a very good idea of what's around us and environment. Our brain then filters that whole thing and then decides based on our prior experience and our thoughts and whatever ideas we have, what we've learned from the past, in what is the next action, most appropriate action to carry out.
Okay.
But that's not how it works.
No?
No. What the brain actually does, because that's a very slow way for it to do. By the time it's decided the action and executed it, the environmental conditions change.
Mm-hmm.
You're too late. So what it actually is doing is it is predicting what's going to happen in the next millisecond in the environment on a continuous level. And it makes corrections to those models as it goes along, as it receives feedback on its actions. Because that's much more quicker. Because imagine, if you have to execute something, let's say, just for giving a silly example, you see a tiger.
Okay.
You want to run, that's the first action. But by the time you've thought, oh, this is a tiger, I need to run, and start your body priming up for the run, it's too late.
Okay.
So it is building this thing and it's getting your body ready for action that it decides is appropriate for that predictive model and keeps on doing that. So when you train, your brain learns to be more accurate in its predictions.
Yeah, okay.
And that's how you learn. So the more times you do the same action, effectively, you're giving the brain more and more time of learning of the same set of circumstances, which then becomes much more confident in its execution, and hence the actions. You see this in sports.
When you repeat the same thing over and over again, you see with us.
Exactly. Well,
even if I'm doing routine cataracts, if you're learning from case 1,000 to case 5,000, you learn so much, even if 99% of the cases are routine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah. It's that. And that brings out a different aspect of understanding of learning, mm-hmm. because we remember only bits of our past history, because we can't store every bit of information.
Yeah, too much.
So we have to make a turn of meaning, sense of what we see or what we think we see. And the same thing happens when you do surgery. You know, when I sit and as a trainee or whatever, when I watch you do operations, when someone else watches someone else do operations, they're picking it up. They're learning they go along. But they can't learn everything. They can't remember everything. So you make a heuristics. You make a rule that, okay, if this happens, this happens.
Yeah.
This is from your past experience. Okay, that's your learning.
Right.
Now, if you've made the wrong meaning out of that event, the next time you apply that, you'll end up with the wrong action.
Well, yeah, for sure.
And the research shows in the surgical complications field, obviously, is that the factor that determines poor outcomes from surgical complications is the wrong choice of action, not the execution of that action.
So you capsule breaks, and then the wrong actions I pulled out of the eye. Now, no matter what you do, you're behind the eight ball.
Exactly.
Instead of staying in the eye, keep the infusion on, keep the AC inflated.
Because you know you have a model of what's going to happen.
Right, yeah.
But if you saw someone else, or if you didn't have that explained to you, or not just explained, but if you didn't make that meaning out of that observation.
Right.
And that's where the learning comes. That's where the mentorship comes. That's where people like you, with the body of work you're doing and cataract coach, makes a huge difference. Because you're not just putting out videos. They can see tons of videos on YouTube. No, what you're actually doing is you're teaching.
Yeah.
You're filtering it. You're giving them the meaning of all those videos as to how it applies and how it learns.
Yeah, you're so right. Because there are other videos online that I'll watch of cataract surgery or other eye surgeries that are just the video and they're not annotated. There's no talking in them.
Yeah.
It's far less learning.
It is. It is. And it's tougher to learn the other way around.
Far less, yeah.
So, but again, this is the technology of learning. This is AI that'll come into education. It's coming in now. So
far, the AI in education is all the university students who get the assignment, generate a ChatGPT output, give it to the professor, but then the professor uses AI to
check it,
to read it and grade it, and then send it back. And you know, I saw this post recently that sometimes we can't, even the AI detectors aren't even that good. Like the AI detector was given the USA Declaration of Independence.
Sure.
It came back that it was 99% AI. And there was no AI in 1776.
And we know that.
Right.
That we think there are these AI detectors, but they're totally inaccurate.
It's nonsense.
You can't rely on them.
Yeah.
You can prompt AI to humanize content.
Right.
Easily done. Instead of asking it to write language purely on probability, you can personally train your AI. So you could input all your written information or whatever that you've generated into that. Learn from that. And the tone it'll come with is what you wish to do. So all these things make the AI thing interesting, fascinating, great potential. Mm-hmm. It's how we harness that potential sensibly is the challenge.
And, yeah. Well, going back to your question on the ethics, I mean, yeah, I guess the surgeon's really at fault, but then if you look at how far self-driving cars have come, a self-driving car now, like a Tesla, is actually pretty reasonable. Not perfect, but there are actual self-driving cars that are driverless in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I've been in one.
The Waymos.
The Waymos. When I was in LA for the ACRS, I tried it. And not just tried it, I tried grabbing the steering wheel just to see what it does. And shut, it really told me off.
You're very brave. So, but then the question is, okay, the Waymo's in an accident. The Waymo hits a pedestrian and injures a pedestrian. Who's at fault?
The owner of the Waymo is at fault, essentially. Yeah. But the question really comes, would that accident have happened, or the chances of that accident happening, would they have been more or less than what the Waymo was if a human was driving it?
Mm. That's hard to say, right?
That's hard to say. That's hard to say.
Well, and then, like you said, there's something to be said for experience. We know for sure in surgery, a complication is far more likely to happen in a young surgeon's hands compared to an experienced or seasoned surgeon.
Indeed. And it's the experience. Yeah. I don't think it's just the number. I'm sure you've sat with starting surgeons, or relatively inexperienced
for
surgeons.
For more than 20 years.
Within two cases, you see those people whose hands are just exceptional. Mm-hmm. I call them hands positive. And then you also see the other end of the spectrum, which is hands negative.
Yeah.
And the majority are people in the middle.
Right.
But you can pick up the extremes very easily.
Yeah, for sure.
But the middle...
Within a few cases.
Exactly. Yeah. Within a few cases. And it's that middle which forms the bulk. And they are the people who will grow and learn and teach and pass on the traditions as we've received it from our seniors.
So let's brainstorm.
Yeah.
Decades into the future. Patient still develops cataracts. We haven't figured that one out yet. We don't have the magical drops.
I hope not.
So the patient gets their eye scan in your clinic. It's all automated, all super high tech. Patient obviously gives their input. You get a prescription for the patient, like you talked about. The patient gets realistic expectations. Hopefully by then we have accommodation, the coming lenses.
Yeah.
The robotic cataract surgery machine will do the whole case. Mm-hmm. What's our role?
Hold the patient's hand. But even that will be replaced, I think. And that's something which we seriously need to consider in terms of the full healthcare ecosystem. Because if you look at the trend over the last 50, 60 years, let's say the healthcare money pie is shared between the industry, which supplies the tech, the doctors, and the facilities, the hospitals and all. Now, over the last 50 years, the proportion that's been going to the tech and the industry is climbing.
For sure.
As is the facility. And the squeeze is on
the doctors.
And that's because the cost of new technology comes up.
Right.
The cost of regulations and running hospitals and those facilities goes up. That trend is just going to accelerate.
Oh, even worse than it is now?
Even worse than what it is now.
Oh.
And with AI, it could well hit an inflection point, maybe 10, 20, 40, 50 years from now, where you could consider surgeons to be perhaps doing something similar to what Uber drivers are doing now.
Oh, wow.
An aggregator may turn up, which aggregates the whole lot.
Wow.
It's a wild way of thinking it. Yeah. It's impossible to predict, but when you're predicting in these kind of timescales, you can only speculate, you can only fantasize if you ever think of it that way.
Yeah, be a different world.
It'll be a different world. It'll be a totally different world. And imagine the companies who will be controlling that ecosystem. They won't be the medical device companies, they'll be the tech companies.
Right.
Our patients will be, we complain about Google doctor patients.
Right. This will be worse.
This will be incredibly different because our patients will be so much better educated themselves with the AI.
Well, luckily we're not there. I've had patients email me. saying, doctor, I have this and this. I don't quite understand this. I looked it up in ChatGPT. Here's ChatGPT's answer. And I'm like, oh my gosh, now you want me to have a conversation with you about what you found on ChatGPT? She's like, I don't know if the juice is worth the squeeze at this point.
No, but you could come up, you can think of coming up with systems in AI which actually provide credible education to patients.
Yeah.
They will be incredibly useful for us. If we get educated patients, a much better patient than
always.
Someone
yeah.
who doesn't. And we spend so much time in educating them.
Right.
So any help in that direction will be useful. And I suspect humans by then would also have a different mindset of interacting with technology and healthcare. And the expectations would be very different to what you and I and our patients are looking at.
Wow. Yeah, I don't. Maybe we won't need. Maybe we won't need so many ophthalmologists in the future. You only need so many surgeons, period, or physicians. Certainly, right now, if I was a radiologist, I'd be panicked. If I was a purely diagnostic radiologist, correct, doing no procedures,
primary care physicians.
Wow. Yeah.
They already chatbots will do quite a lot of that work.
Right.
The challenge for the AIs is going to be the emotional side of it. You know, that care element, which as doctors,
that's hard.
We are
for a robot,
increasingly kind of not focusing on because of the systems of medicine we work within. Which
Just patient throughput.
Patient throughput and everything. And you can't. So this thing about caring for a patient, which is really, I believe that is how a patient judges the quality of what happens to
for
them.
For sure, for
how
sure.
How you talk to them, how you
for
make
sure.
them feel. That's a big form of it. And if a patient feels cared for, they trust, they relate to you in a different way, they don't come across as people who are out to get you, sue you, it's a totally different relationship.
Yeah, there's the saying, patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
You care, correct, correct.
And I totally get it.
And sadly, that's... the systems are making that more challenging for doctors to do that. But it is the most critical part of it. And that will be the biggest challenge for AI to offer. Although there are some elements of that that people are trying now. So as you know, there are tons of AI apps where you can have AI girlfriends and boyfriends and to talk to for emotional support.
And they won't give you any grief.
And they won't give you any grief. You can switch them off whenever you want. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety, for depression. All these things are being delivered through, or at least people are trying to deliver these things through AI. Behavior modifications.
Wow. The AI will love you more than your kids do. But luckily we still have dogs. Dogs will always love you more.
Absolutely. You could have AI dogs too. But it's because the technology is evolving, we just don't know.
Right.
But that's what makes it exciting, doesn't it?
So when do you think we'll have access to, let's go back to ophthalmology, for your custom lens AI, which sounds fantastic.
So we are doing the algorithmic validation now. Once that's finished, we will then start pilot patient testing to confirm the predictive algorithms as such. So with a bit of luck, everything going to plan, first quarter next year, we should have the product ready to go commercial.
Wow, that'll be great.
We are in the process of going through regulatory approvals in the States, in the UK and Europe. The States and the UK, we anticipate from our consultants, first quarter next year.
Wow.
Europe sometime end of next year. That's the plan. And that's where we are heading to at the moment.
Will it be specific then to each country? Like for me, don't give me a prescription for an IOL that's not FDA approved, right?
So, So the algorithms, one of the things that I was very keen to implement is I didn't want a system which dictates to the surgeon what to do.
Okay.
And as you know, there are many areas of our practice where there is no hard and fast hard and fast scientific evidence that you must do it this way and not this way. So all those gray areas.
Judgments.
Yes. All those gray areas, we allow, we make the surgeon choose those parameters as preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And the algorithms run within those boundary conditions. So you could choose any lens you wish. You could choose any lens combination strategy you wish. So I do binocular customization. So I start off with every patient as being eligible for every lens.
All right.
But the key objective, the universal objective for every patient I would treat is I want to get patients a binocular vision, 6.9 or better, 20/30 or better, from infinity to 40 centimeters in a continuous manner, not up and down.
No dead zones in the vision.
No dead zones in the vision.
Okay.
With the highest binocular contrast and as minimal dysphotopsia as you can.
That sounds fantastic. Wow.
So I believe that's what all our patients want we can get to. Okay. And you're not, we can get to this more or less binocularly with current technology.
Sure.
Monocularly we can't, but binocularly we can with our current technology. So I tend to mix lenses. So for the last 10 years maybe, I've hardly ever used binocular multifocals.
Wow, that's something different.
Because...
So you're always mix and match. You're going to put a multifocal in one and then a monofocal of some sort of the other?
So I actually...
Or
I don't call it mix and match. So the way I classify these various strategies for lens things is, the first thing is, I put the same lens in both eyes.
Okay.
That's one strategy, that the commonest strategy.
Right.
Now, my take on that is you put the lens in both eyes, but the patient can still tell differences between the eyes because the outcomes are slightly different.
Right,
the two eyes.
Always.
So just because you put the same lens doesn't mean you generate the same retinal image.
Right, right.
Okay. Then comes this mix and match approach. You say, but what you're doing there is you predetermining what you will do in the two eyes.
Okay.
In the dominant eye, I do this, and the non-dominant eye, I do this, and that's fixed. What I tend to do is what I call binocular customization.
All right.
And that strategy is based on how we use the interpatient variation of outcomes to maximize the... So, for example, if you use an enhanced multifocal, let's say the eye has, for example, you put it, you know, and I know about 30% of eyes with the eye hands will read very well.
Yeah.
But I can't predict which ones.
Right.
So let's do it, find out what happens,
and
then design a strategy for the second eye to get to that binocular objective of generating the best visual
overall percept
rather than thinking of lenses. So if you put binocular multifocals, your brain never receives the high contrast image from any eye.
From either eye, yeah.
So when it fuses the two and does what it does, there is a limitation to what it will lift it up to.
Sure.
There's a great paper by Hayashi and from 2011 where they call hybrid monovision, where they tested dominant eye monofocal and a multifocal in the non-dominant eye.
And
they tested the visual acuity, contrast, and everything. The visual acuity profile is the same as the multifocal.
Really?
The binocular contrast in photopic.
Same as the monofocal.
Same as the monofocal. Because the fusion brings it up.
So the brain picks out whatever it needs for each eye, picks the data.
Correct. So you can get the range without necessarily compromising the contrast in both eyes. Because you end up with a better binocular contrast. The same thing happens, for example, with when we do monovision.
Okay.
So if we keep the two eyes within a diopter of each other,
sure,
it's physiological. That's not monovision. I call that nanovision, just to differentiate. But the key feature is, if you keep the two eyes within a diopter, the binocular contrast is higher than monocular contrast in each eye.
See, because you get fusion.
Right.
If the disparity goes beyond one diopter, you get retinal rivalry.
Right.
And the binocular contrast is in fact reduced compared to any eye. Till it gets to about 2.5, 3 diopters, where you get retinal suppression, because the difference between the two images is so much that the brain says, let's shut one down, and the binocular and monocular contrast is the same.
So very interesting. I never really thought about that way. But the catch you have now, though, when you put a monofocal in one eye and a multifocal in the other, and you got to make sure the patient is not going to use their hand, cover one eye, cover the other, go back and forth and make themselves crazy.
So that's setting patient expectations up front.
Right.
So the way I call this as think vision, not lenses.
Okay.
Because our patients understand vision. Our fellow doctors and others struggle with the optics of intraocular lenses to try and explain it. How can we expect our patients to understand that?
Right.
And
yet,
you have to think in terms of binocular visual perception, not individual eye lenses.
Right. So we should think more like we're doing vision surgery, not just a lens surgery.
Correct. So we are actually designing retinal images in each eye to maximize that binocular vision percept.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what we're doing.
No, if you do it that way, for sure. I have another trick I tell patients. Never cover one eye and then flip to the other eye and cover back and forth. Because that prevents the brain from syncing the images. It's bad for your brain. Don't do that.
Correct. Yeah. And it's exactly that. You say, you know, we've designed intentional differences between the two eyes.
Right.
So that when your brain puts the two together, you get more than the sum of the individual.
Right.
They understand that. And when we do the functional vision testing with the panfocals, they actually get it. They relate to it because they can see the differences that each of things will
do. Does it matter let's say you do the multifocal one eye, monofocal the other, does it matter which dominant eye or non-dominant eye gets which lens?
I think the dominant eye always has to have the higher contrast image.
The monofocal one.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be monofocal. In fact, I stopped using monofocals.
It would be EDOF.
The default was either enhanced monofocals, monofocal plus, or EDOFs. Whichever way you want to do this. So the options now come down to, you could use an enhanced monofocal and a multifocal to cover the near if you want to. You could choose binocular EDOFs with hardly any dysphotopsia.
Sure.
And just shift them half a diopter if you need to, or 3/4 of a diopter.
Makes sense.
So there's hardly any space where you need to use binocular multifocals.
Right. But that's the way we're actually, in the USA, most commonly doing it is, you want multifocals, both eyes plano with the same lens.
Correct. And that, I think, is driven by the system. Because there is this whole premium lens thing, for which you can charge and drive the systems that way. When I used to practice, in my practice, we had one price.
Right.
Irrespective of the lens.
So you got to make them happy. That's most important.
We give you the best vision.
Yeah.
How we do it is my job. I'll tell you how and why, but that's how we do it. So it doesn't matter if it's a monofocal with monovision.
Right.
Or whatever, whether it's a femto or a manual or whatever. No, we do the best that's possible for your eyes to get you the best outcome.
Right.
That's what you come to us for. Not a pizza menu from which you choose lenses.
Now, with all this kind of neat way of teaching these advanced concepts, you have started a deep dive meeting. I want to talk about this. Tell me about this. So we're participating, for me, the first time this year,
correct,
a deep dive day. Tell us about this day.
So the deep dive day, really, I thought, hey, Uday is coming. We can't let go of not utilizing your exceptional skills at teaching in this kind of stuff. So this is when we've designed this deep dive into complex cataract surgery, where we are going to cover all complex cataract surgery situations in terms of dealing with them in a very detailed manner, so that the delegates end up with practical ways they can go back and utilize those insights right. into their day-to-day option. The other interesting session we're doing in that, as you know, is this whole concept of cognition in complications. How do you think when you face complications? That's a fascinating area which is hardly ever covered in any topics that I have come across. And that's going to be a fascinating thing to cover and see the feedback on that. So we've done these deep dives before. So last year we did a deep dive in astigmatism, for example. Prior to that, we've done this in other aspects of that. So on the Thursday, we did a deep dive. And on the Friday, as you know, it's the 23rd year for the state-of-the-art refractive and cataract surgery meeting. And that's how that 2 days work out.
Well, I know the talks are going to be really great. They always have been historically. But I had to make all new talks.
That's the only reason.
No, because I speak a lot.
Yeah.
Like I spoke in 20 countries last year.
Okay.
And so I can't tell you how many hundreds of talks are already on my laptop, ready to go.
Sure.
But these are things like, okay, well, you know, I don't actually have a talk on that already made. So, you know what? I'm going to put the hours, I'm going to make one.
I'm flattered with that.
I put a lot
you to do 4 new talks.
A lot.
A lot of new talks, yes.
So I
have always designed the content.
Yeah.
As you know, the whole meeting content is designed by me.
Right.
I think of it and think it through and get all the stalwarts in.
After 25 years, you're pretty good at it.
And so the program is designed to be 50% relevant to current practice and 50% aspirational. So show the delegates what's coming, what's possible, new ways of thinking. And that combination seems to work very well.
But you need to bring this meeting, though, to other corners of the world.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I think we talked about this earlier. I think we need to collaborate with similar skilled experts, teachers all around the planet to deliver these kind of detailed, hands-on educational meetings to all surgeons.
Well, agree.
It would be a huge thing, and I think we need to work on this together. It'd be great.
Oh, I think it'll be so well received. I think it'll be, honestly, programs like that, I probably learn more than I contribute. There's so much good stuff.
But we all do. That's the reason we teach, because we learn.
Right.
That's the reason we teach, is because we learn. It's that whole, my father has, I was telling you about him earlier. So he always quotes a particular Sanskrit piece of text, which says, Vidyadhanam Sarvadhanam Pradhanam. Which means the wealth of knowledge is the best class of wealth a human can ever aspire to.
Okay.
So this is something that was written maybe 2,000 years ago. And then it goes on to give you the reasons why.
Okay.
It says, na bhratru bhajyam, you cannot split it as you give it as inheritance to your children or your brother. No one can steal it from you. And the more of it you have, it doesn't create a burden on you.
Right.
Okay. And the most unique feature of this type of wealth is the only way you can grow this is by sharing it freely with everyone.
Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful?
It really is. Yeah.
Vidyadhanam, Sarvadhanam, Pradhanam.
Amazing. But that's obviously very, very keen insight. And it's sharing the knowledge is, that's basically what we're doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I was very surprised in traveling that there are plenty of places, plenty of countries where your resident or registrar surgical training is not really sufficient, not great.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the reason the cataract could become so popular is that it's just equalized everything. I teach you everything. And my favorite is I give away all the secrets. Whatever secrets I know, I will teach you all of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's there. That's how I learned.
Of course.
No one, I didn't have to pay anyone to learn specific insights.
Yeah.
You learn. I remember
sitting in the ACRS as a trainee on Jack Holliday's course,
right,
where he would for 2.5 hours on his own, just
brilliant.
The rooms used to be packed.
Yeah.
But you came out with your head buzzing,
right,
with all the insights and the new learnings and everything, which you then went back and your patients got the benefit of it,
right,
in the end because you got better.
Do you think we're shifting away from some of those big, huge meetings? This year, ASRS Los Angeles was, it seemed like 50% attendance level. It was pretty light on the attendance.
True, true.
So I'm just wondering, are people getting more learning online? Like, even my best of cattle coach that I did at ASRS, maybe we had, let's say, 500 people in the room.
Hmm. That's a huge number.
It was packed.
Yeah.
But 10,000 will see it when I put it up online.
Indeed.
Maybe, honestly, even more than that.
And that's where the world's heading, because we can do it now. Well, previously, we couldn't. I remember the time when I was a trainee, we had to carry those double slide decks,
carousels,
which had to be packed in our hand luggage.
Yeah.
And if you were annoyed with one of your colleagues, you just opened it
and dropped
turned it upside down.
Or, like, actually, when I started ophthalmology, they had just started to phase that out. I was one of the very first presenters who I presented everything on PowerPoint, and they were like, whoa, no slides?
Yeah.
And the other thing besides PowerPoint was I actually was one of the very first to record and embed my video in the PowerPoint, and people were blown away. Because at that time, literally, these meetings, they'd show you VHS tapes of videos.
Yeah, Betamax tapes.
Betamax, yeah. Well, yeah.
I remember Bobby Osher would carry a suitcase full of them for all his symposiums.
Oh, he's the god. Yeah, he is.
He's the god of it.
He's the godfather of surgical video. That's where I learned from.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
He's amazing. Incredible. I spent a week with him way back at his practice, and it was an eye-opener to the great, amazing person. Like many.
For sure. Like so many great people in ophthalmology. Yeah, we stand on the shoulders of giants, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For sure. But yeah, it's amazing just how much we can learn. And we better keep up our learning before the AI robots take us over.
No, I think.
I'm saying it only in jest, but I think it'll be a good thing. I always say embrace new technology. I think you'll get AI already is being a benefit to us in ophthalmology. You've got your whole process going, which I think is fantastic with custom lens AI. Me with my group with John Lattice have now patents in the US and also worldwide with regards to AI being used in certain methods of doing IOL calculations.
Yeah.
And so I think it's definitely proving to be a benefit already, and it'll get better and better. Even the robotic company I'm working with, we are using AI, even that, to improve actually the way the surgery is performed.
It's fascinating. I mean, all those approaches. I've just come back from ACOS, where we had a full session on digital ophthalmology and AI, and it was incredible watching all the different approaches people are taking to try and explore and deliver value from this particular technology. And as it evolves, it's going to be amazing. I think it will be great. It's a great future, and it's very exciting to be. So I look back in my career, and I think I've been so lucky that I had the Phaco revolution happen during my
right.
The excimer revolution happened.
Expo laser for sure.
Training. The internet flourished on its full bloom. And now the AI has come in, and I have another chance to go at another technology. It's incredibly lucky to be able to have this kind of opportunity.
Oh, that's for sure. Absolutely. I think we're living in a great time here, and I think we'll all do very, very well with this. So I'll put down below in our podcast in the links, we'll put down your Custom Lens AI link for that if you want to learn more about that.
Sure.
And then again, I want to look forward to using it. And I also definitely want to look forward to getting these meetings set up with you around the world.
It'll be wonderful. And I look forward to getting you onboarded as one of the testers. It'd be great to get you involved at an early stage into this. And it's fantastic. And it's great to have you back here in Hull for the state-of-the-art meeting, for the deep dive.
20 years later.
20 years later, still looking the same youthful.
Oh, no, I don't know. A lot more gray hair, a lot less hair, but
more wisdom, I hope.
A lot more wisdom, that is for sure.
That's
Milan, thank you so much for doing this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for the time.
Of course.
And, Wonderful to have you.
And I will remind our listeners and viewers, remember, every single week we got a new Cataract Coach podcast. We got a new Red Rounds podcast every week. Every single day we have a new Cataract Coach video, 2,600 plus and counting. And every day we have a new Red Rounds video. So until next time, I'll catch you later.